name is Richard Lamparsky, and if you're an old radio fan, you know that by that theme, which is Drigo's Serenade, is that correct? That today we're going to find out what happens when a girl marries, because my guests are Miss Mary Jane Higby and Mr. Louis Van Ruten. Was that the right theme?
That's Drigo's the right theme, Serenade? Exactly, yes.
Did it put you in a mood?
Yes.
How long since you've heard that?
Oh, not too long. I think about 8 years.
We
went off very late, yes. We were one of the last soap operas to go, and then after that I did Nora Drake at CBS, and that took in another 18 months, and I left the air, I think, in 59.
You were the title role in Nora Drake?
Yes. Mm-hmm. The last Nora Drake. Previously, there had been several others.
Mr. Van Druten?
Well, all I was going to say is it's a good theme, because it's Drigo's Serenade from the Millions of Harlequin, and we were all Harlequins, and a lot of us made millions.
That's very apt.
It was very lucrative. I guess it was, though, for radio actors, wasn't it?
Well, it was extraordinarily lucrative, considering the fact that it came into full flower during the Depression. And it was a period of stability for at least a fairly large group of actors, I would think that
you could say that over 600 actors in New York alone were making better than what would be known as a good living.
And then you could do a play on...
You could do a play on the side in the evenings, although that would cut in, because in those days, remember, we had a great many evening shows, and they were among the highest paid.
No, but I mean you could have a soap opera,
oh, yes,
a running part for five days a week and still work on Broadway.
It was done.
I managed to squeeze in a few plays.
Yes. It was done, but it was difficult to do because everything was live. Remember that none of the network shows could be recorded. And for a long time, they had a ruling against any sort of recorded effect.
Right?
Oh,
even
the commercials
couldn't be recorded.
Sometimes in a soap opera, there would be two of us. Say, Louis and I would be the entire cast of characters for that day, but the room would be full of people who were doing the commercial. There would be a harpist and a trio,
yeah,
and an organist.
A couple of actors, if it was a dramatized spot,
right,
and there you were.
That's, you know, hard to believe when you work in radio today, because, you know, this station is, like most of them, is on the air 7 days a week and about 20 hours a day. And there are times when there are hours and hours that there's only one person here, an announcer. And the programming goes on, you know, talk programs, all recorded.
Then we had something called a repeat. You had to repeat the show sometimes for the West Coast, and many of those took place at midnight, didn't they? So the networks were really humming at midnight very often. A lot of people.
The Kate Smith show used to go from 1 to 2, as I recall.
Right, yes. And that was because of the time difference with the Pacific Coast.
And those had to be live. It wasn't until about the last 4 or 5 years of the big time in radio that those rebroadcasts could be done from a recording taken off the air of the first one. And if something had gone on in the first one, you'd be called back to do it anyway.
Yes, that's true.
Your program, When a Girl Marries, was written by Elaine Carrington.
Yes.
I knew that without looking it up because she got such good billing, wasn't it? Didn't they used to say Elaine Carrington's When a Girl Marries?
That's right. That's right. She also wrote Pepper Young's Family.
Was that the other? I knew there was another one.
And Rosemary.
Yeah.
There were three. She was one of, I would say, of five or six at the most, of the very top daytime serial writers.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you say, Louis, that she...
I would say that she would... I'm right in there. I was almost going to say the top, but I don't want to offend anybody.
Yes.
Is she still around?
No. She passed on, several years ago.
Yeah.
The great lady, I suppose, of daytime serials is Erna Phillips, who has never been off the air since 1931.
Yeah, and she's still on.
She's still on. She has two daytime serials, one on each network.
Yeah.
I didn't know there were such things left.
Television.
Well, she made the transition.
She made the transition very easily. She had radio and TV going for a long time.
Well, I think that probably the most prolific of all writers was Mrs. Hummert.
Although she actually didn't
do the dialogue writing, I don't believe. She laid out the plot lines or storylines for every soap opera that Black and Semple and Hummert had. And they were legion.
Oh, yes, they had...
10 or 15 at one point.
Oh, many more than that.
Sure, they had the nighttime shows.
And they had the finger right in the pie. I know that she used to attend every audition for an important character.
I'd say 3 out of 4 of the radio programs I do, I revive, I should say, like we're doing today, Our Hummert shows. Yeah. I think even Mr. Keene and things like that
were
Hummert
shows. Oh, yes, Mr. Theater and Mr. Keene and Mr. Comedian.
I'd love very much to interview Ann Hummert. Does either of you see her anymore?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I saw her just about a week ago.
Really? Because Arthur Hughes was on my program about a year ago, and I said, I know he's very friendly with her, and I said, you know, if you could possibly induce her to do the program, because she really should have some stories to tell. And he said, well, she was quite broken up, I guess, after Frank Hummert died. And she really, he said, doesn't like to be reminded of the old days. But he said maybe again in a year or so.
That's quite true.
So I'd like to try it again.
Quite
now
true.
That the
she is still very, very much broken up.
She was his secretary. Did you know that?
In the beginning. Well,
yes.
I'll tell you something further back than that. She was a classmate of my wife's in college.
Oh, is that?
A fact that I don't think she ever knew, and which I didn't trade on.
She was at one time a reporter on the Paris Herald. And Mr. Hummert was the top copywriter for Lasker, who was almost the father of modern advertising.
Yeah, Albert Lasker, right?
Yes, the reason I bring this out is that the serials themselves seemed so naive to us, didn't they, Lou?
Yes, they did.
Still, these were not naive people at all. It was very carefully tailored to the market.
Did they seem naive to you at the time when you were doing them? Were you kind of amused by them?
Oh, the serials?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, all the serials seem naive to me. They still do.
Well, they do now, I think, to me. But at the time, I found them quite
brilliant. Well, I don't think that you could go into a program like, say, Stella Dallas and really take it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
As a piece of great dramatic literature, it was you were playing in a strip, as we know the comic strips today, which carry storylines and are not at all funny, and yet you cannot take them seriously. And these programs were designed to appeal to an intellectual level and an emotional level that was pretty earthy and pretty primitive, because that was the great audience, you say, that they were trying to reach. A sophisticated daytime soap would never have died a morning.
Well, they reached me, I must say, touched me, and many times.
Oh, they could.
Well, there was very good writing. Let's make no
mistake
about it.
There was a lot of hope, and there was very good acting in them, too.
Very
I don't
good
think
acting,
that
yeah.
there's any question that as far that the best daytime serial that I ever heard was Helen Trent at the time that a young woman named Martha Alexander was writing it, which was for a period of about 2 years, and it really stepped off almost into literature. She did wonderfully with it, and that opinion was corroborated by Thurber when he did a series of articles he did on daytime radio. He listened for a long time and then wrote a series of articles, which later became part of a book, and he singled her out, too. I was fortunate in that I was playing the heavy during those years on Helen Trent. Did a lot of different things.
You were playing Cynthia Swanson?
Oh, yes.
Well, didn't Vivian Smolin play Cynthia Swanson either later or before you?
No, I don't think Vivian ever did. I was the original Cynthia Swanson, and when I left, when they took When a Girl Marries for a brief period to California, I had to give up Helen Trent. And Andrea Wallace took my place.
I'm going to look this
That's
up
right,
now.
That's right, isn't it, Louis? Isn't that very long?
I don't recall.
Little Irish girl.
But while he's looking this up, I would like to point out one thing, that our judgment was tempered in those days because we were working on such a great variety of things, some of which were very beautifully written, like, for instance, Norman Corwin's program.
Oh, yes.
So that you couldn't come out of a Norman Corwin show and go and do a soap opera with the vestments and the candles anymore. You know, the difference in level was very
not.
Marked.
I was going to say that Vivian Smolin, not Vivian Smolin, but Mary Jane Higbee, that I nearly met, when this program first started, about nearly 2.5 years ago, because you're a Vivian Smolin's neighbor, aren't you?
That's right.
Yeah, and I went up to record a program, and she said, I can't promise, but I'll try to get Mary Jane Higbee to come in, you know, just say a few words. But you'd gone shopping or something.
That was nice.
So you didn't, but we got a very good program together anyway. I'm still looking at the book I'm looking at is the Golden Radio's Golden Age, which I always recommend when I do a program on radio because it's very accurate. But speaking of books, why don't you all plug your books? Grossman Press sent me a copy of Mr. Van Ruten's book, but I didn't get it. So tell me about it so I can go out and buy a copy.
Well, The book is rather strange because it was the result of a lot of doodling on the back of scripts during rehearsals in the old radio days. It was written over a period of, I should say, 15 years. What I did was to take Mother Goose rhymes and write them in French, but that is phonetic French, so that when you read them with a heavy French accent, you're really reciting Mother Goose in English. And then, much to my amazement, I discovered that these little poems in French had a meaning all their own, completely divorced from the original meaning. So I decided to put footnotes, translations, and made it a very academic book, played it with a straight face, and it's really quite funny sometimes. At least people tell me it is.
It's one of the wildest pieces of sophisticated camp I've ever seen in my life. And it has a far-reaching appeal. I must talk about this because I'm so excited about it. I read it when I was visiting some friends in Milwaukee. I read it to a couple of children who were aged 11 and 12, and I've never seen such reactions in my life because it sounds at first... you are reading French, and slowly it dawns on you that you're hearing an overtone of something else, and the little boy was just writhing with delight when he heard it.
I do recall now seeing the review of it in the New York Times book section. It was very good notice.
The New York Times did me very beautifully, and this week's Time magazine has a very nice review of it.
Did you say the title of it?
Mother Goose Ram.
Better spell that out, because they want to go out and get a copy.
Well, it's M-O-T-S, D apostrophe H-E-U-R-E-S, G-O-U-S-S-E-S, R-A-M-E-S. Mother Goose Ram.
By Louis Van Ruten.
By Louis Van Ruten.
Published by Grossman. Mary Jane Higbee, they can't go out and buy your book, but tell them about it, because I'm dying to see it.
Well, I have just completed what amounts to a history of the years of radio from 1932 until the end of radio as we knew it, the great days of radio, largely from an autobiographical standpoint. I wasn't really interested primarily in conveying facts of my own life, only as they touched on the radio field and as the radio field touched on my life. And since it made up about, I would say, 14 hours a day there for many years, radio did, the two were pretty well intertwined. And with the help of my various friends, like Mr. Van Ruten and Mr. Stotz Cotsworth, who was front page Farrell for so many years, and John Gibson and other friends, I think that the book is quite accurate and very factual. It is as complete as I can make it, but it's from the lighthearted point of view. It's not a social document by any means. It's really the crazy and wild things that happened to us, because it was a very...
It was an insane period,
yes,
in its way. It was very curious. I went to the coast several times to make pictures, and while I was out there, I wouldn't do any radio at all, partly as a vacation, really. And when I came back to New York after 3 or 4 or 5 weeks on the coast, I found that the first 2 or 3 days, I was behind everybody. I hadn't gotten back into that high pitch of nervous excitement that was just part of the everyday life of a radio actor. You were always just about to give a performance.
We would give as many as 7 a day.
Yeah.
That was not impossible.
No.
And it wasn't, I would think that would be infrequent, but 5 wasn't infrequent.
I gave 10 one day.
One day?
Yeah. But that was a fluke, and it was very funny. There'd been a blizzard, and New York was snowed under. And I had a morning show. I fortunately lived near the subway that dropped me off right at NBC. And I went in and did my show, and as soon as I came out, about 9:30, I was grabbed by hands. And I just went from one studio to another, doing all the parts in the world that I ever heard of, played several leads, people that couldn't get in from the suburbs to do the show. I didn't tend that day.
Yes, a sign, the blizzard was the sign for the Manhattan actors to rush to the stations, even if they had no commitments for that day, because they knew the people couldn't get in from Westchester and Connecticut. And they tell me Chicago was even worse than a blizzard. And Brett Morrison, who was the shadow later and at that time was doing the first nighter. He was the voice of the
Brett
first nighter.
Brett Morrison, he's been on.
Well, he woke up one morning and saw the thick snow on the ground, so he quickly hired a sleigh. And he was one of, and took all the actors in his neighborhood to the radio station. And they were four people turned up to do the full day. And in those days, Chicago was the home of the, I think they had about 75% of the dramatic broadcast at that time, yes. So he said that day they were just, they never rehearsed anything. They just read everything cold. And there was another wonderful story. Bernadine Flynn, who was Sade of Thick and Sade, came in that day.
She still lives there, by the way.
Oh, does she?
Chicago.
Mm-hmm. And she did a show all by herself. She just took the script and read everyone's part and said, oh, now, oh, I didn't quite hear what you said. I can't hear you over the lawnmower. But, oh, you want me to go? She did it that way. Did the whole 15-minute show.
Is that in your book? That's a charming story. You know, you didn't tell the title of your book. See, I'm an expert at plugging books.
The show must go on. And on? That's the title
of
the book.
That's very cute. We have no publication date
set yet. No.
But, well, when it comes out, you must come back and be Nora Drake, and we'll plug it some more.
I would love to.
Did your show have any giveaways that you remember?
When a Girl Marries never had a giveaway.
But
I worked on many shows that did, and you did,
too. Oh, yes.
Too. We used to stop on Helen Trent and give away a lovebird pin. And it had a deathless phrase I shall never forget. Field and Farrington, the announcer, used to say, a lovebird pin with real simulated gold flashing.
Gold flashing.
Real simulated gold flashing. And we'd stop in the middle of a dramatic scene like Sensible People. We'd be having a terrible fight. I'd say, Helen, where did you get that lovely pin? She'd say, oh, this pin. And we'd talk about it for about 3 minutes, and then we'd go back to, I hate you, don't you dare darken my door again. They were always woven into the script.
I thought of one, a giveaway. Recently, I went to see a preview of Gone with the Wind, a trade screening. And I was sitting at the intermission talking to the fellow I was with, who doesn't remember radio, he's too young. And I said, you know, there was a Scarlett O'Hara pin, and I think it was Campbell's Soup sponsored some program, because there was a Scarlett O'Hara cake in which one poured a can of tomato soup. And that, now, doesn't that sound awful? But I remember.
It really sounds
yes,
awful.
Yes, because the lady next door to us at that time, Mrs. Fetterwall in Detroit, made one. And her husband came home, and she had cut a slice out of it. And he said, what the hell is that, red cake? And wouldn't eat it. But that was a Scarlett O'Hara cake. But if you bought whatever it was, you got a Scarlett O'Hara pin, because in one of the scenes, I didn't think to look in the picture, she wears kind of a little cameo on one of her dresses, and that's what it was. It came in, I don't know.
Now, this is
does
used to
or
me.
Something like
I haven't
that.
Heard of that.
I remember.
Well, most of the giveaways were used very, very much by the children's programs.
Yeah.
Now, I was in my first lead, actually, in radio was on a program in Cleveland for the Kroger Baking Company, the local, called the Pirate Club. And the kids would cut off so many box tops, and they would get a Pirate Chief hat and a Pirate Chief sweatshirt and a Pirate Chief this and a Pirate Chief that. And the program finally went bust because the kids were winning all the prizes and the company couldn't afford them.
They learned later to make the simulated gold.
Yes,
I don't remember that particular program, Mr. Van Ruten, but the Kroger stores, I think, are all throughout the Midwest. I guess they still are.
Well, they were at that time. They covered the state of Ohio, Cincinnati.
They were in Michigan,
Cleveland.
Too.
Were they at that time?
Michigan.
I used to do recordings for the Kroger company, I remember.
Did you both begin in Chicago?
No, I started in Hollywood. I started in the old Bing Crosby show. The first thing I did was the old Shell show. With Edward Everett Horton, yes. Uh-huh.
I started in Cleveland.
On what? Was it the Pirate show?
It was that. We had quite a few shows in Cleveland at the time.
Yeah, Detroit did too. Yeah. People think it was just Hollywood and New York.
No. Chicago. Detroit had quite a few shows right up to the end. You see the Green Hornet and
the Lone Ranger were both Detroit shows.
The Challenge of the Yukon, Ned Jordan, Secret Agent.
Yeah. Cleveland didn't have as many network shows originating there, but they had a great many local shows.
Cleveland had a show, I think it came from Cleveland, but it was called something like the Battle of the Cities. And it would be between Cleveland and Detroit.
Yeah.
Do you remember? It was a quiz show, and they would have contestants on from both. It was very much like the Julia Sanderson, Frank Crummett show. By the way, I announced her as being dead about a year ago on this program, and she is not dead. She lives in Springfield, Massachusetts, at the local Sheraton Hotel there. And if anyone wants to write to her, she replies. But that's where she is.
Oh. Was that the Battle of the Sexes?
Battle of the Sexes,
I was on that one time, and I...
As a contestant?
Yes. I distinguished myself by saying that... what was the thing now? It was a gun, and I thought it was a salad dressing. Smith and Wesson. People who never listened to me on anything else heard me on that. I got letters from all my friends. They said, one Smith and Wesson. I said, salad dressing.
Yes, it was the men against the women.
That's right. Yeah, and we had a group of radio people as a sort of publicity thing. I think we had the Thin Man. And
it seems to me during every program someone would say, oh, Miss Sanderson, won't you sing something for us? And more often than not, it was they wouldn't believe me. Which I guess was her big hit in The Gale from Utah. 1911, just think. She was a star in 1911.
Fabulous.
It really is. What other roles did you play? I think you told a few, Miss Higby. Van Ruten?
Well, I think that the one part that I played the longest was Bulldog Drummond's Gentleman Denny. And I played that something like 9 years.
Are any of the Bulldog Drummonds around? Because I'd love to know on that.
Let's see. George Coloris is in England. Ned Weaver is on the coast. And I forget who was. Santis Ortega is in town.
Oh, that's right. Yes. He was Bulldog.
Yes, he was Bulldog.
We must get together again and do a Bulldog.
And there was a period, I think, when there was a replacement. I forget whether it was Ortega or Ned Weaver, but we had about four. Uh-huh. So that only did the show once.
I love that show. I remember the opening with the foghorns.
Yes,
and the announcer would say,
feet.
Out of the fog, out of the night.
Yes.
That was Bulldog Grumman. Is that right?
Indeed, yes.
Yeah, and they played that horn that always made me think of B.O., the Lifebuoy ad.
Well, George Coloris was, I think, the most fun to work with in that bunch. And I want to tell you a little story about him, because the last minute of the show was a scene between Bulldog Drummond and myself, in which he would explain to me how he had solved the crime. And George was a terrible clown, and on the air one day, I was waiting for a cue from the control room to start singing after the music bridge. And all of a sudden, from the other side of the microphone, comes Coloris' voice saying, well, Denny, suppose you explain to me this week how I solved the crime. And left me with my tongue hanging out, my mouth open, and I had to rewrite the whole final scene. There was nobody left in the control room that I could see. They were all on the floor.
Did they take those things lightly? I mean, because I don't think in television they let you play around like
no,
that.
No, they wouldn't
today,
dare.
Would
they wouldn't dare. But you see, the thing that happened in radio, particularly when you were on a show week after week after week, you became so accustomed to working with the people that if an untoward accident happened, you could cover very quickly because you knew that everybody would react and how they would react. And in some shows, when you've got a madman like George Coloris, who's a beautiful, marvelous actor, but with a pixie sense of humor, anything could happen. And very often did.
I have seen, I think perhaps the commercial was the most serious thing.
Yes.
And still, I have seen an actor, on several occasions, I've seen different actors walk up to the announcer and light the script.
Yes.
Take a cigarette lighter and light the announcer's script while the announcer was in mid-commercial. And he'd be holding one corner and then the other, hoping he could get through it.
I think we've got about 7 minutes left, so I think we should talk a little bit about When a Girl Marries, because in case someone tuned in and they didn't know what we were doing the program about, or they'd never heard When a Girl Marries, tell a little bit about the plot, will you?
Oh, well, the story of When a Girl Marries was a wealthy girl who married a young man who had been brought up by a widowed mother and not had the advantages that her family had, and the lines were very definitely drawn between their friends, and she made the selection of going and living in a small house on the other side of town, over the track, so to speak, and there was always the conflict there between the two families. And it was set up very, very well in the beginning because it was possible of enormous ramifications. His brother, he was an attorney, but his brother ran a garage, and there was the difficulty with that family that could be brought in. So we had many plots going, At the same time, Louis, you were on that program many times. I remember you as a criminal one time.
Well, I...
And I remember one time, I think perhaps you were on the time when I really made history as one of the most drawn-out sequences that ever took place in radio. It's become quite historic now. The leading lady who was caught for 7 days in a revolving door. I started through a door, and 7 days later I came out. But, of course, you know, it was a long, drawn-out time.
I had heard that, but I didn't know what program it was.
Yes, that was When a Girl Marries. And, of course, it wasn't. They didn't detail every moment of doing that door. It was because there were so many other plots going. And they'd take you off to another section of town, and they'd come back, and I'd still be in the revolving door. And, Louis, you had a similar thing on Pretty Kitty Kelly, didn't you, when you got into an elevator?
We got into an elevator on Monday and didn't get off until the following Monday, going up three floors.
Probably the slowest descent in history.
They used to fry an egg for two or three days at least on Bob Perkins.
Yeah.
I didn't know you were on Pretty Kitty Kelly. If I had known that, I'd have worn a pin I have, and it says, Columbia Broadcasting System, listen to Pretty Kitty Kelly, and it's in a lovely shade of green, and has her picture, Eileen Blackburn.
Was Eileen Blackburn, yeah.
Right in the center.
Bud Collier was on that, too.
Yeah, he was the...
Nat Crowley.
And Dick Colmar.
Oh, yes, Dick was on.
The reason that I played John's other wife was that Dick was on both shows, and he had to get from Columbia to NBC in an ambulance, which he had hired, which would take them across because the programs were practically back-to-back. And then I guess the Humberts were a little nervous about this, and they said, this can't go on, we'll have to get another John. So I was it.
He was playing Jack Orpington, millionaire playboy, on Pretty Kitty Kelly at the time. And
I played three heavies on that show. In fact, Pretty Kitty Kelly was my first soap opera in New York.
Oh, really?
And I went on playing Mr. Astrakhan.
Oh, that's right, Mr. Astrakhan. I remember because I did commercials on it quite often. If you talk to any of the radio people who were working in radio in depth, you'll find out that all of us did, I would say, many thousands of programs.
Oh.
You see, we were on nearly everything. I suppose Louis Van Wooten was on every soap opera that came out of New York.
I was on every one except one, Easy Aces. I never got on that.
Oh, I was never on Easy Aces. My husband was.
It was a very, very closed, a very small cast. And
yes,
didn't
I was going to say,
actors.
They didn't, really.
But I was on practically every other daytime show, and I don't think that I missed any of the nighttime shows. I did them at least once.
I think we have just enough time, about 2 minutes, while our engineer is queuing up the love theme again from When a Girl Marries, to plug your books. Mary Jane Higbee's won't be out for a while, but the name of it is The Show Must Go On and On. Is that right? By Mary Jane Higbee. We can look forward to that. Louis Van Ruten, you do yours. I can't pronounce it.
Oh, now, come on. It's Mother Goose Ram. Mother Goose rhymes.
And I haven't read it, so I can't recommend it, but the New York Times did, and Mary Jane Higbee did.
I recommend it very highly. I was just dying to say, Ekiri de kiri doc, de meuse ran oop de clock.
Well, I'd like to say thanks to you both, Mary Jane Higbee, who played the main role in When a Girl Marries for so many years, and Mr. Louis Van Ruten, very well-known veteran radio actor. So until next week at the same time, this is Richard Lamparski. Thank you for listening. Good night.